Welcome back to another episode of ABA Mom. I'm your host, Allie, a mom of five, and today we're diving into compassionate care in the field of applied behavior analysis. Joining me today is Kayla Sanchez, a board-certified behavior analyst at Connect and Care in North Carolina. Kayla not only brings professional expertise to the conversation, but also deeply personal perspective. She's a mom to a child with ADHD, giving her unique insight into both the sides of therapeutic relationship. And in this episode, we'll talk about the compassionate care really looks like in practice and how empathy, understanding strength, client relationships, and how being both a BCBA and a parent can shape the way we show up for families we serve. So grab your coffee, settle in, and jump into a meaningful conversation with Kayla Santos on ABA Mom. Kayla, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Allie. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah,
excited to dive in.
Yeah, me too. So as both a BCBA and a parent of a child with ADHD, how has your dual perspective shaped the way you approach client care?
Sure. I think even prior to knowing that my child had a diagnosis of ADHD and anxiety as well, was really just the parent perspective in general, where it was like, oh, wow, I have been this person for my whole life who's always enjoyed working with kids. I was always the cousin at the party playing with the kids, not really like worrying about socializing with the adults. And so I was like, oh, I got this. Like, this whole mom thing, it'll be fine. And then I had him, yeah. And I was like, whoa, I don't have this right now. And so I think that like right off the bat really started to shape that perspective of like, even with the experience and just pure joy I've had working with kids isn't what's gonna get me all the way in this parenting journey. Like, it almost felt like it wasn't enough, which is not true necessarily, but in the throes of newbornhood and all of that, it was just a very humbling experience. So all that to say that I think once that happened, and as he moved through, you know, infant stage to toddlerhood, and it was like, okay, now I'm seeing the trials and tribulations that anyone is really going through, whether your child has a diagnosis or not. But wow, like, if this is hard at this level, imagine what it is when you have multiple diagnoses, multiple children with disabilities.
Right.
You know, any kind of combination of those things, and really giving grace to myself, but then also the clients and the families that I work with as well.
Yeah, I think that's a really great point. As a mom of 3 out of 5 of my kids have an ADHD diagnosis, and myself as well. Actually, my husband does too. So it definitely is a unique perspective that, you know, raising children is already hard. Like you said, like that perspective, whether or not you have like the diagnoses, but wow, like that definitely can change things. You know, for me, I kind of found I was a parent and then a BCBA. And I don't know if I would have done it backwards if I would have the same compassion that I do. So I think that's a very interesting perspective. And I think it definitely changes things. You just kind of relate on a totally different level. So I really appreciate you sharing that perspective, because I think that is absolutely true. It's just kind of like a whoa moment, like, wow, this stuff is hard. I get it.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's not to say that everybody needs to be a parent in order to be a compassionate caring BCBA. But I do think that having some of that experience also can benefit in some ways, where it's like, you know, where if you don't have a child, maybe this does feel like a panic moment. Why are they doing this all of a sudden? Like, you know, what's going on? And then once you're a parent, you're like, kids do weird stuff sometimes. It just happens.
Yeah. No,
you know, that's not something that we need to like, oh my gosh, let's make a program and a plan for it. Let's see and know that kids are kids at the end of the day.
That's really true. And I think too, like you said, you don't have to be a parent to be a good analyst, but it definitely gives you a different perspective, because I think too, like, we could write programs for everything. Like, we could be like, oh, let's make a program for that. And I just, you know, I think too, a lot of us like to do, okay, like, so the highest level, like, you know, murder, which we hope is not happening, right? Like, this is like the worst thing, right? Like aggression, whatever it may be. And then like, okay, like, you know, they do some weird stuff. So maybe there's like some vocalizations or like stemming or something is very kind of low on that, like a program. But I think that's a good point too. Like, we don't necessarily have to make programs for some of the weird stuff. Kids do weird stuff in general. Yeah. Even neurotypical kids do weird stuff.
Right, right. Yeah. And I don't mean that in like a negative connotation. It's just like,
no, not at all.
They're learning the, like, how to just be a human. And so I think that even adults do bizarre things sometimes, and that's okay. Like, again, it's all just part of how our world is made. And it's great that we all have differences and do different things. And we don't have to panic about every little thing, I guess.
Yeah, no, that's true. And it's true. You know, it just reminded me of a client I used to have that was like, you know, 3. And I was like, well, he's doing this thing, but so are his peers. So I'm like, it's really not that unusual. Like, you know, or like the expectation of like a 3-year-old not having like tantrum. It's like, they're going to probably have tantrums because 3-year-olds just have tantrums. They don't have good social emotional regulation or good communication yet. So I think some of those things, like, you know, and it's just, I think it definitely, like you said, just brings in like a new perspective and being able to see it, especially if you've had, you know, if you've had a BCBA that's like, that have had a 3-year-old in their life versus somebody who's never had a 3-year-old in their life, it's definitely a different perspective on that end too.
Yeah.
What does compassionate care mean to you in the context of ABA?
So a little bit of a hot take, I think, is that I do feel like in a lot of ways that the word compassion has just become such a buzzword in our field. I think that we can still absolutely practice in that way, but that's kind of like the headline that everybody is putting out there of like compassionate care. And again, not that that's necessarily a bad thing. I think that's just the theme that we're on right now. Anything, there are trends, and eventually that word will kind of die down and it'll be another word. So to me, like, just taking that, and it's really just about being a good human, which I know is not maybe something that is easy to define, but I think that we are in a helping profession, and so at the end of the day, it's really just about being there, being supportive, being kind, being caring, being empathetic. So again, still similar words that we kind of just all lump into this idea of compassionate care.
Right.
But like, I think that it's really just about living within the values that we have, and we might have different values across clinicians, but generally, like, our values are around not doing harm to clients and their families. You know, we're there for socially significant change that's meaningful, and so on and so forth. Like, we could list so many things out, but that's really where I see that. And sometimes I chuckle to myself when I see like that's the headline right now of this is what we do. And to me, like, I worry about that because I think that in some ways, you know, parents are very vulnerable, and that so they're like, okay, like, that sounds great. I mean, same here as a parent, like, yeah, I want someone who is kind and caring and all of those things to my child, of course. But I think because of the trend of that word, that it's easy to get sucked in and just be like, oh, you know, these people say that they do this and that and that. But at the end of the day, are they living within those values? Are they taking the steps towards being those things? And if they're not, then again, it's just this like bright neon sign on the road that you're like, oh, okay, I'll take a pit stop there, but not really gaining anything from it.
And I really like what you said, because it is such a buzzword. I think for the last couple years, it's like I see it everywhere, compassionate care. Like, so I think that's a really good point, but we should just be human first, like you said, just being compassionate, being a good human, which I think the scientist part is like, okay, so what does that look like? It's much harder to define what being a good human is versus like writing a program, right? I actually have a good example. Yesterday, I had an RBT who the teacher was just having like a moment, like just like a human, like rough time, like a moment. And you know, like the para in the classroom was out, like there was just a lot going on, and it's like a preschool classroom, and she just needed like a moment. And so the RBT, who I was super impressed with, just said, "Hey, what do you need right now? Can I start passing out lunches to you, to the kids?" And just started doing it. And I'm just like, "No, we're not here for the classroom. No, we're not. We're here for a specific client." But I'm like, wow, like what amazing rapport you're building with that teacher now, because now she's like, okay, like I can trust this person, and like this person is supporting like me in my classroom and supporting this kiddo. So I thought it was very compassionate of her. I was very impressed. I was like, that was amazing. I was like, I kind of sat there like a deer in headlights. I'm like, I don't know what to do.
Yeah, right.
So, but I was very impressed by that. And I think, you know, that's just like the human, like normal thing to do. And I think that's the issue, is we get really set in like our focus, what is we're due, because we want to be professional. We don't want to have a dual relationship. And I think sometimes that gets lost, because we also just need to care about each other. Like you said, we're in a field where we're helping people. So we need to be shown as like people that are helpful. So I think what you said about that, the compassion and actually doing it, is good. Yeah.
Yeah, and I
Go
think
ahead.
too that, especially I see more for BTs and RBTs, but kind of this fear because we have a board and we have an ethics code that they get nervous about that, and rightfully so, but because they don't want to be called out for doing something wrong. But I think that sometimes
Right.
that pushes too far into that human versus professional line where it's like, nope, I have to be on. And the story that I shared with you about a client who had fallen right before a session and gotten hurt, and the family had just been moving, and so everything was kind of still packed away. The family asked like the RBT, hey, is there any way that you could bring a Band-Aid? We're really sorry, like, we'll of course cover it. We just can't find one, and we don't have the ability to leave the house right now. And it wasn't like he was hurt in a way that needed serious medical attention. And you could tell that like
Right.
initially there was that like what's the right move here? And that was the advice I gave her, was like, you're human first. And again, like what would that have done to the relationship if you just showed up and you're like, sorry, can't, like too bad. Similar to the example that you just gave with the teacher of like, now that's not only that benefited the teacher in the moment, but long term that's also benefiting your client because she's gonna have a better relationship with you. She's gonna see that, people already have a perception of ABA as it is, but like, wow, okay, we can go on beyond certain, like, again, if people have this view of DTT or like this is this very standard, like set straight view of ABA. Now that's shifting things a little bit and shaping her view of us and what we're there for. We're not just there for our client. Of course, we're primarily there for our client, but we're trying to help for the greater good as well.
Right. I think that's too, just kind of that bigger picture. And then, you know, I did this CU at a conference, and they were passing out like different foods from like different cultures and stuff like that. I'm like, that's cool. Like, I'm hungry. But they were just kind of talking about how, like, when you go to a family's home, and this has been a conversation I think you probably had before too. It's like, if you're offered food, like, should you take it, like, or not? Because there's that boundary of like, am I crossing that boundary? But then there's like that cultural consideration, like, hey, like, if you don't take it, like, if I don't take, you know, like, if you like made this empanada, which just looks delicious, and I don't take it, like, that I don't know, that could definitely hinder some rapport too. So what are your kind of thoughts on that, on the food taking, like in households?
Yeah, I think that as with any situation, there's a level of discrimination that we need to have and be able to weigh out those scenarios. So I think that also being a person who always wants to take care of other people, offer things, make sure they're comfortable, like I could totally see myself if I had providers coming into my home, asking them if they wanted anything, offering that. And for me, that's just like a kind gesture. It's not something that like would damage any kind of relationships in terms of my culture. But yeah, I absolutely have worked with people where like that's their way of showing that they care, that you're connected. I actually was just having a conversation with a dear friend of mine who's in the field about helping parents to understand their child's like connection style, kind of similar to maybe like a love language, but connection style, because I think that I'm taking a little bit of a turn here, but for families who maybe have a vision of what their relationship with their child is going to look like, and then it might not be that, being able to give them ways to pinpoint, oh, okay, this is how my child connects with me. So similarly to that, like being able to pinpoint, this is how this family is connecting with me and sees me as a valuable person within the scope of their child's team, their home. So I think that, yeah, again, really just weighing that. And if it's really going to damage the relationship, then, I mean, even if it's not going to damage it, but like you still want to have that connection, that rapport. If you're comfortable with it and they're comfortable with it, then yeah, of course, I think that's okay. It's one thing, like, for them to offer it here and there, for you to try. I think if you're eating meals at their house every night of the week, that's a little different. But certainly this, like, you know, hey, we made this special meal. Do you want to try it? Maybe that in turn also will help your client if that's not a food that they're particularly eating, modeling that and all of that. So yeah, I do think that always being in the mindset of deny, deny, deny is not the right way either.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that. I think there has to be a good balance. Like the expectation is like, oh, I'm not going to go over there and have dinner every night. But like if they offer me like a cookie or like a coffee or something like that, like you can say yes. But like I've even gone to like family's houses where like I pack my own dinner because like mealtime is like a, you know, a thing for them, but still offer me like a side or something like that, you know, because I think they just want to feel a part of it. And I think it also brings that kind of normalcy. Like it's not really normal for somebody to come to your house and then like pack all their own food, you know what I mean? Like it's a normal thing. Like, and I think you're showing the clients that too, like what's kind of socially acceptable. And I like what you said too about like maybe this isn't a food that the client likes and you can model that for them too. So that's a really good point as well, like modeling eating that food. I've also like I was working with this family that was from Greece, and I had no idea that's like a coffee is like like all the time coffee. It's like, hey, my 2 p.m. coffee, like, you know, morning coffee, like all the time coffee. I was like, okay. I was like, I thought I drank a lot of coffee, but apparently that is like a really big thing in that culture, which I wasn't aware of. But I was like, okay, like I get it. I think I could be Greek. Like I could do this. Yeah. But it was very interesting. So I was offered coffee quite often. I was like, but at some point, at some level, I was like, I even if I wanted, like I can't keep taking your coffee.
Right.
So I think that balance is really important. So I like what you said about that. And then just having that, like, you're not going to eat dinner with them every night, like, you know, and expect like, you know, that to be like the expectation, but like to try some things and like be able to build that rapport, I think is important.
Yeah. Human too, that, you know, similar to the seeing your teacher in the grocery store. What? My teacher grocery shops? Like, yeah, they still need to buy groceries and food. So yeah, we eat, we do fun things. We have lives, you know, sure, outside of what we do for work. So again, building that connection of, okay, you're not just this like stiff person that's here and isn't able to engage with us in a bigger way. So yeah, you might eat, you might drink, you might use the bathroom, all those things.
Yeah. Yeah, I had an old boss that would made a joke. It's like, you know, like before we could take, like have something with that small of amount of like, you can receive a gift if it's under, you know, $10, you know, where before that I was like, no, don't take anything. You can't have water, anything. So he would be like, don't use the bathroom. So, and I think too, like, you know, accepting a bottle of water, that's very socially acceptable. So I think a lot of that is really good modeling for our clients as well. Just like, that would be a normal thing. Somebody comes to your house and they might say yes to a bottle of water. That's pretty normal.
Yep.
So what are some small practical things that you think that analysts and RBTs can do every day to show compassion and build rapport?
Yeah, I think that really having that mindset of empathy and consistency. So I'm here for you, following up on things that maybe a family has asked you about. I think it's easy in our busy lifestyle as BCBAs to be be like, okay, yes, let's follow up about that, or I'll check in about that. And then sometimes those things get lost, and it happens, but trying as much as we can to really follow up on those things, even if a parent might kind of forget about it too, just to say, hey, I'm circling back about that. We can check in about that. Is that still a priority? Is, you know, what do you need around that? I think are those really small ways that we can show that to them. And also the collaboration around not only the weaknesses that their child might be demonstrating at that time, but also their strengths. I think that that is really significant. I've seen BCBAs go a long way when they've been able to demonstrate or show the family, like, hey, this is a strength. This is something really cool that your kid's doing, because it's easy to get lost in the day-to-day of that. And I think I've had countless times where I've had that discussion with a family, maybe at intake or something, like, what's something your kid does really well? And they sit there and they're like, oh my gosh, that's awful of me. Like, I'm not sure. And I always say, like, no judgment, no pressure. Like, we can come back to that if you think of something. But nobody maybe has asked them that before. Or again, like, their kid has several strengths, but they're just in the thick of it, and it's easy to focus on the hard things when you're doing it day in and day out. And so I think that's another way that RBTs, BCBAs can show families that, you know, maybe even on a graph it's not showing that there's this great significant progress, but hey, they did this really awesome thing today, and that's super cool. And maybe it's not even just about what the client did, but how the family responded or what they did to encourage that. And really playing on that with the family too, of, hey, you did a really great job with that. And not in a way that, again, is like, we're checking off some data points to say that the parent is doing this, like, truly, genuinely, you responded to that really well, and now your child is doing X or is able to move on from something that historically would have evoked an hour-long tantrum or, you know, something like that. So really just being a cheerleader for them, I would say.
Yeah, I think that is very important too, to be a cheerleader. And you're right, some of that stuff may not be on the graph. Maybe it won't be a data point, but it still could be something that can be recognized in that way. And, you know, I think a lot of parents I work with really respond to that verbal praise, because I think they hear so much, and it depends on their child, right? But like, they'll hear a lot of negativity, and sometimes like the schools, like, you'll hear like, great, another phone call, like, here we go, like, what did he do again, or whatever it may be. So they're used to that. I'm not used to like, hey, I did this really great thing for my child, or my child did this really great thing today. Like, that's not something that they're kind of receiving a lot of. So I think that is a really good point in a way to really show compassion, but also like just build that rapport with the parents. Like, you're right, they did do that. Like, so it just brings a new perspective for them. So I really like that you say that, because I think that's really important for families, because I feel like they hear so much negativity about their child sometimes. And it's like, but they do really good things too.
Yeah, I just saw someone share a slide from the New Jersey conference that's happening, I think, right now. And I don't know who the presenter was or anything like that, but essentially the slide said, like, when the room is filled with negative comments about a child, be the one to, like, flip the script, essentially, and share the positive things about them rather than feed into all of that negativity. And I just really loved that, both from a clinician perspective, but as a parent too. I remember over the summer, my son went to a piano camp, basically, and the counselor, the teacher, made some comment about like how he had done really well. Am I still cut?
Oh, can you repeat that? It's cut out really bad.
Sorry. I don't know. I'm on my like good network, so I'm not sure why it's doing that. I'm sorry. Can you still hear me now? Or is it
coming? No, you're okay.
Okay.
I can hear you way better now. Yeah.
Okay. So both from a clinician standpoint, but from a parent standpoint, I remember over the summer, my son went to a camp, and this was his first summer of doing any kind of camp, and I was very nervous about it. And the teacher of the camp made some comment about like he was like a joy to have. He did really well. And there was maybe more specifics to it, but I just remember thinking to myself, like, oh, wow, it's not often that I hear someone say that about my kid. So like, it really was touching that she said that and he was able to succeed with her. So
no, that's awesome. Yeah. And I really like what you said about flipping the script. I feel like that's really important too, just kind of turning it around for them. So you could be the one that can hear the positive things. You can share those positive things with your child, which, you know, is great for that rapport. And then just also getting them to see like not it's not all bad. You know, and then also I think that helps with shaping behavior, because I think parents sometimes, and everyone kind of just looks at the bigger picture, but like, you know, we're focused on shaping behavior. So any of those small successes over time, like it's still a success. So I think that's also really important for families too. So how does being a parent to your child with ADHD influence the way that you understand support families? How do you think that helps?
I think that it helps in specifically like in the realm of ADHD, just really realizing how MOs change so much, so quick, so fast. And I mean, a lot of our clients have dual diagnoses too. And even if they don't have an ADHD diagnosis necessarily, like that can still definitely be the case. But wow, like I think that early on in his life, there is very much this like, I'm going to make this plan, or, you know, we're going to do this and implement that and da 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 da. And then realizing like, he doesn't care about that anymore. Like maybe it was for an hour. Maybe it was for a day. Maybe it stuck for a week. If it stuck for a week, wow, we're doing well. But yeah, I think that was really a big thing. And, you know, in terms of clients and working with them, I think it's always been much easier for me to pivot because we're in there for these short sessions of time versus when you're in it with your kid all day, every day, being exhausted is like, whoa, we just flip from this to that and, you know, so on and so forth. Like being able to live that, as difficult as it is sometimes, is able to help me again realize what my families might be going through that I'm working with. And maybe not that specifically, but I think that there have been quite a few things in his childhood so far that have really been like, okay, so this is how it might feel. And even with my background and knowledge and skills that I might have, how hard it is to still be able to implement things with him. That has been a very humbling experience, where if I'm struggling to do that, then what are the families that I'm working with who don't have that ABA background or knowledge to be able to implement that? And I think that that's really affected in a positive way my practice with families, being able to say like, here's what we could do as a response, but also I get that you're a parent, you have multiple children. You're not sitting with your child one-to-one all day, every day. It's just not feasible.
Right.
So it might look like that when we're in session, but I know that when you're home at 5 p.m. and you have to cook dinner and you have to get everyone bathed and you have to, you know, all the things that we have to check off as parents, that the best laid plan sometimes just like cannot be executed. And so that mindset has really been helpful in collaborating with parents more about like having an open conversation about, here's what I'm thinking, but do you feel like that's feasible? Like, could we make that happen? Or what are the barriers that you see to that? How can we change it to make it easier for you? Because if it's too hard for you, you're not going to do it, first of all. Or if you do it, there still might be some like resentment, honestly, which is something I don't think that anyone would necessarily want to voice, but it's there of like, I have to do this. Like, I'm being told by this professional that this is the way to do it. And like, I'm so tapped out right now that's not benefiting the client and the family in the long run either. So really trying to be able to work with them of still explaining what you might think is like the best intervention at the time, but also realizing that they still might not be able to do it, and right. Then being creative.
Yeah, you're absolutely
how
right
to make it happen.
I think that's true. And I like going back to what you said about the motivation changes frequently, especially, you know, with a lot of kids, but I think especially with an ADHD diagnosis, just because everything is like, okay, like I did this thing and then I'm bored. Because I know that for me and my kids, like we start things and then we're distracted and like we come back to this thing, but like to stay in like one thing or like this one thing be important, it can be important like for a period of time. Like this is really important to me. And then you kind of outgrow it and you're like, not anymore. So there's a lot of like half done projects. There's a lot of like, you know, maybe I like a food for a while, right? Or my kids do that too. Like my daughter was like obsessed with ramen and now she doesn't even want to touch ramen. And so just kind of keeping an open mind that like, you know, I've heard it before too, parents say, well, it doesn't work, it's not working, and just kind of changing up like that reinforcer all the time and just figuring out. So maybe just kind of being like, so what do you like now? Do we need to figure out what it is this week or, you know, or this day? And just always keeping an open mind to that. Just having a different perspective as an ABA provider that they're not, they may not have that knowledge and background, and just being able to be like, hey, like, you know, what do I do? Because it is hard. Like it's hard being a parent in general, just like trying to check everything off your box that's rough. Because there's nights where I'm just like, we're skipping a shower tonight. Like we're done, you know, where we got home too late or whatever it might be. And just kind of keeping like lowering those demands sometimes. And I think that just letting the parents know that like, it's okay. And there's always like other tools in the toolbox that can be used. So
yeah,
I like how you take the pressure off of parents. I think that's important.
Yeah. And I think to your point too, about like motivation and changing things up, is also the perspective of like blanket statements that people make about what a kid isn't doing right now or what they are doing. So for example, my son, like one might say that his attention to a task is minimal to none, but I can tell you that when it's something that he really loves and is really motivated by, he spent 3 hours cutting wood the other day. Like he loved that and was so invested in it and didn't break from that. So it's not that he isn't able to attend at all. It's that whatever you're saying he's not attending to is not capturing his interest. And so I think that that is another perspective that we can bring to the table as clinicians, of being like, whoa, 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 let's not say they aren't doing this at all. Are there times when they are showing this skill? What are the variables at play when they do demonstrate that skill? And, you know, taking that into consideration, being able to use that within your treatment planning and building on that. Because yeah, there are going to be times, like for my son, that he is going to have to attend to things that maybe he doesn't like at some point in some way. But also kind of moving from that point is another one that I think about all the time, and I do with my clients and my children, is thinking of like zooming out to the bigger picture of like, what does this look like in our everyday world? So as another example with my child, like group work is really, really hard for him right now. And yeah, maybe like we're working towards that as a goal that we'll get to eventually. But also I think about when he's graduated from high school, he might choose to go to college, he might not, he might go to a technical school, all those things. But he gets to choose the environment that he's going to thrive in. Is it going to be a small environment, not really engaging with a lot of people? Is it going to be a huge environment where he's constantly interacting with people? And so school in that way is really just like square peg round hole situation, where it's really the only environment where we're kind of forced to do these things that we don't want to do. I mean, yeah, okay, adult everyday life, like I don't want to do my laundry, sure, but in terms of just like autonomy and choice in the setting that you're in, that's like one of the only ones that really is that way. And so
yeah,
his school team might think I'm a little crazy in that perspective of like, yeah, cool. It would be great if he could maybe learn with the entire class at some point. But right now, like if he can learn the material in a small group, let's do that for right now, because that's where he's going to thrive and that's how he's going to maintain. And his like ability to demonstrate academics is very important to him. And so if we lose that, we're going to lose a whole lot of other things. So let's try to build that environment that he can thrive in right now, and incrementally over time expose him more to that whole group situation. But again, at the end of the day, you know, years from now, he's going to be able to choose what setting he wants to work and thrive and live in. So, sorry, I took a quick turn there, but
no, I really like that. No, I really honestly, like, I think that's such a great perspective on, like, you know, one day, like, he'll be able to choose, like, what he wants to do, and what environment, like, will be best for him to learn in. Or maybe, like, he'll be up for the challenge, like, hey, this is challenging for me, but I'm gonna try. I hate too what you're saying about the smaller group and, like, needing, like, certain things, like, where environments will he'll thrive. I hate too what is just hard as parents is that sometimes your kids need a different environment or a different setting. And a lot of times it's standing out, right? So, like, my kiddo looks different than the other kids, or, like, they have this accommodation and they don't want, like, you know, for example, my daughter with ADHD, like, used to have, like, a divider as a part of her 504 plan. And then she got to middle school and she's like, no more divider. I don't want it, like, anymore as accommodation for me because I stand out for my peers. And I'm like, if you don't want it and it's too much for you, like, you can definitely take it down. Like, I'm not gonna make you be the only one in your class to sit there with a divider. In elementary school, that was totally acceptable, but she went to middle school and it was just no longer socially acceptable. And I think too, like, and she was able to advocate that, which is important because not all kids can advocate for things like that for themselves. But I think, you know, as parents, like, it's just like, you know, you want your kids to be, and I don't want to use the word normal, but as much like their peers as they possibly can be. But I think it's important to, like, remove yourself from that. It's like, what is going to help them be the most successful? Like, what is going to help them in the long run? Like, okay, so maybe temporarily, like, we're in a small group right now. Like, this is where we are. That's fine. Mm-hmm. And then maybe in a few years from now, maybe we won't be. So I like that you have that perspective and have that open mind, because I think that's really important. It's very hard as a parent to have something different or unique for your child.
Right.
And I definitely think it will help you, like, with parents. Like, I'm sure it does.
Yeah. Oh, well, and that's
like,
the
that perspective is, like,
yeah, that I was just going to give too, is that, like, I have a client who does have some vocal communication, but we're still advocating for the use of an AAC device. And I know that there was some hesitancy around that. Like, you know, he has some vocal communication. What is an AAC device going to do? And at the same time, I also had a supervisee, not on the same case, but she's going through grad school, and she had been asking questions about, like, well, is it, if I'm looking at his communication, how am I scoring? Like, if he were to use an AAC device versus manned or vocally and things like that. And I said to her, I was like, some days I order my coffee on my phone, so I don't have to talk to anyone else. If we zoom out, bigger picture, there are so many different ways that all of us engage in our world that we take for granted. And it's not until we get asked questions by families, get asked questions by supervisees of, like, how does this work? What should it be? And that's when I really like to be like, okay, let's apply this to your everyday life. Maybe today you are going to Dunkin' to order your coffee face to face. Maybe tomorrow you're going to order it on the app because you're just like, I don't want to have to put more effort into things than I really need to.
Yeah. No, I love that too. I love that example of, like, the mobile order versus going in, because I can definitely relate. And I think a lot of parents can relate to that too. Like, so how are you going to order your coffee today? But it's all communication. So I think that's really important too. So how can families advocate for compassionate care when choosing a provider or working with a team?
I think sometimes, yes, there's advocacy on the front end of it, but you kind of don't know what you're going to get sometimes until you get it. And so I think the big thing is, yes, advocating at the forefront where you can. Unfortunately, some companies are like, this is just the provider that I have in your area. Like, here you go. And so with that, kind of two things, like, I think that in the field of ABA, it's more taboo or, like, looked down upon if a family is like, hey, this provider's just not working. But how many times have you maybe, like, had a doctor that you started with and you were like, something, we're just not clicking. Like, For me, I'm looking for a right. warm and fuzzy doctor. Like, I want to have a connection with my doctor, even if they're just there to treat me medically. And again, like, not that I need to know their life story, but having some relationship there, some connection. So it's not just a parent being difficult if they ask for a new RBT or a new BCBA. And I think that it's okay that they do. Sometimes you just don't click with people, and that's okay. And again, so like in a medical setting, that's so common. People don't really think anything of it when you do that. Or you could just switch locations altogether. Unfortunately, with ABA, there's some more like limitations to that. Maybe you live in a rural area and you just don't have options to switch providers, things like that. But I think that it's a tough balance for parents sometimes to be like, ooh, do I just stick with this person, even though we don't really click, so that I can make sure that my child gets services, versus advocating and saying this isn't the right fit, but then maybe going without for a while, or maybe like altogether. That's a really loaded decision for families. And it's very personal.
Right.
Of course, like they can make that choice in any way that they feel best. But I do think that sometimes sticking with someone who's not the right fit isn't going to be a long-term benefit.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And I think too, that's a lot of families feel that I might have to go without services if I say something, or how long before they find someone else. Like, I think it's important, if possible, because I think you said just like those areas where there just aren't a lot of providers. It could be that's your only provider in your area, which is tricky. But I think it's important to kind of have like a plan in place, like for like in, with agencies, just kind of like, okay, so if this isn't a good fit, like, and I think the meet and greet is really important too, because if you meet somebody and you're like right off the bat, and it's like, I'm not so sure, I guess I'll give them a chance because I really want my kid to have services. That's not really a good always been a good sign. I mean, you know, sometimes like as you get to know somebody, it changes, but usually like you said, like a doctor, like if a doctor walks in and they kind of come off the wrong way or they're not very friendly, I don't know that I want to come back and try them to be my doctor again. And I think that is totally fair that parents feel that way about certain providers too. Mm-hmm. So I know that I'm not always a fit for some families. Yeah. You know, and I'm okay with that. And I like, you know, it's like, okay, like you will find somebody that's a good fit for you. Or same thing with, you know, the RBTs, like, okay, like this isn't, personalities are just aren't matching well. Right. Like, you know, you're not gonna be able to, it will be a challenge to probably build rapport with somebody who right off the bat is like, I'm not so sure.
Right. And sometimes like
sometimes it does. Yeah. And then also there's that newness of like having someone new in your home, and maybe it was just like you're distracted by or whatever it may be. So there's definitely exceptions to that. I just know typically I'm like, that doesn't usually go well when a parent's calling me and I'm like, I'm not so sure. I feel like they're being very nice and polite to me about it.
Right. Yeah. I was just to that point of like, sometimes when a doctor walks into the room, like, you know, right off the bat and you're like, ooh, yeah, this isn't the right move here. And other times it's like, oh, you know, maybe we've had a couple appointments and it's gone fine, but now things are really taking a turn. Sometimes that happens because I see that in companies too, where it's like, things were going so well. What's wrong? And things shift sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So finally, what gives you hope for the future of ABA and for the families you serve?
I think that there are some really great things going on in our field. If you haven't heard of the MODIS assessment that's kind of newly out, it's really nice in the way that, like, for several reasons. There's a portion of it, Dr. Annika, I'm going to mess up her name, I'm so sorry, Hoiberg, I think it is, has... Her dissertation is Kindness is the Method, Not the Reward. And I just think that is such a lovely phrasing, but also like all of the messaging behind that. So that is really something that gives me hope that we have things like that are being disseminated out into our field. That assessment alone is really nice because, again, it's not this black and white. Your child is not doing this or is doing this, like some assessments are. It gives the assessor the ability to score, like, can they do this with some level of prompting? Can they do this completely independently, but it's not yet generalized? Or can they do it and it's generalized and it's maintained over time. So there's really this nice scale, I guess you could say, of being able to demonstrate a child's abilities. And with that, again, that all goes back to like how we're presenting that information to families, what they're being told, the messaging that they're getting of, you know, your kid scored a 2 on this assessment. And then they're like, oh my gosh, they can't.
Right.
They can't do anything. Or again, I actually just presented a CEU yesterday with a colleague about how sometimes these assessments, even our own assessments, like we don't get that many hours to learn about a kid. They do maybe show like they're not demonstrating certain things at that time, but really understanding that when we're assessing them or they're going to get a diagnostic report, this is the first time they've maybe met that person, they're in a new environment, there's all sorts of new variables and we're expecting them to just do it. And so being able to take that with a grain of salt and know and really like value what a parent is saying in terms of like, ooh, okay, maybe they're not doing that on your assessment, but I see them do this every single day. And from the parent perspective, like I've been in that situation where we've been at the testing and maybe he's not demonstrating it. And I'm like, what? Like, why aren't you showing them? I know you do this all day, every day. Very frustrating, humbling, all of those things. So I think that by having materials out in our field where we can demonstrate more incremental progress over time is a really lovely thing, both for the client's sake and the family's sake. And again, this messaging of like kindness to others is not something that they earn. That is just something straight off the bat that we all should have access to. And just because you clap your hands doesn't mean that that's when you're going to get more engagement and more interaction and positivity from me. Like, I'm here for you and I'm going to be kind and considerate and understanding, no matter whether you're engaging in challenging behavior or you're there and ready to engage with me and just ready to go. So I think that that's a really big thing, and kind of goes into the whole conversation about like extinction and, you know, withholding attention for things. And because really that connection, like that is something that I have advocated to my son's team of like, if you're not able to build a connection with him, he is going to do nothing for you. Nothing. Because he knows that you're not in it with him. He knows that even when he's having a bad day, or if he's having a bad day, that you're kind of just over him, but that he only gets your attention and valuable insight when he's doing exactly what you want. He's going to learn over time that like, they don't care when I'm having a hard time. So why am I going to care to do what they want me to do when maybe I'm not struggling so much?
Exactly. That's a really great point too. And I saw something the other day. It was just like, it came up, I think, like on my TikTok. But there was this guy who was just saying, you know, like the function of attention, right? So we would say like, okay, like the function of this is attention because, you know, they're seeking attention, but kind of just flipping it and just, I like how you said connection, because he said, you know, this really the function is connection. Like, how can I connect with somebody else? And I'm like, that's really a kind of a good perspective. It's like, yes, like, we want attention, we want people, you know, to respond to us, all of those things. But it really is more about connection. Like, how can I connect with you, like the person, and finding the, like a good positive way to do that. And I think it's important that we as both parents and practitioners, that we are continuously finding ways to connect with the children that we work with the families, and then with like our own kids too, finding like different ways to connect. And then we don't always have like the quantity of time, but the quality is very important. So whatever that quality looks like, that connection time is very important. So I really like that you use that word too, connection, like having that connection with somebody, because I think it changes the way that we see attention, because we kind of see attention as like, you know, I'm poking you or I'm doing this crazy thing, like you're going to pay attention to me. But really what they're trying to do is just find a way to connect with you.
And I think overall, like that to me, that's kind of my quote unquote buzzword in terms of the theme of practice, is like that connection and community. Community is another big one for me as well, that I think that everybody really needs in some way. And that community looks different for everybody, and what they're seeking right. in terms of their needs. But I think that without that sense of community in some way, that it's really hard to navigate. I really encourage parents to have some sort of outlet, community, connection with people, because I think that even when things are hard, if there's someone that you can be like, hey, this is what we're going through, just being able to like get that out without judgment, being able to, maybe that person says, yeah, we're going through something similar too, and not necessarily having a solution, but just being heard about it is so powerful. Right. And I think kind of going back to what you had said about peers and wanting to really kind of assimilate with peers and be like peers, is that also at some point, I think it's really valuable to kind of be able to be like, this is where we're at, and we need to find our people who understand that. That's been a big thing for me.
Yeah.
In like my journey as a parent, is like, okay, we need to forget those other people, because this feels like high school and it sucks, to be honest with you. And it's not right. every day that I can like get myself into that mindset, but really being like, if you don't understand my kid, if you don't understand the way we live and you don't want to be a part of that, fine. We're going to go find the people that do, because more and more every day, the right. people that I can connect with that also have ADHD or have a child with ADHD, they love my kid. And you can tell that, like, no matter what kind of like quirky things are going on. And those are the people that I value and that I gravitate to and then I want to be around and I want my child to be around.
Yeah, that's a really great point too. Kayla, I just want to thank you so much for your time today and coming on and sharing both your personal story as a parent and then also you. So thank you so much for your time today. And if you want to reach out to Kayla, she's at Connect and Care, and then her information will be linked below. Kayla, thank you so much.
Thanks, Allie. It was great to talk with you.